Explore the RN front page for features and editor's picks.
Good morning on RN. This is Books and Arts Daily, coming to you from the banks of the Torrens River in Adelaide. I'm Michael Cathcart, and it's good to be joining you for Adelaide Writers' Week. Edward St. Albans' Melrose novels tell the story of a profoundly dysfunctional upper-class family called the Melroses. The first book, Nevermind, was published in 1992. Its centrepiece is the horrific rape of young Patrick Melrose by his sadistic and aristocratic father, David. This sickening act of violence reverberates through the series, sending Patrick into a hellish spiral of heroin addiction and mental illness. And to make everything worse, Patrick's mum, Eleanor, refuses to see what is happening. And later on, when Patrick has grown up, she robs him of his one consolation when she leaves the family's large house in France to a new age conman called Seamus. Now, put like that, it all sounds very grim, but these are brilliant and witty stories, a set of razor-edged satires which dissect the snobbery and the arrogance of the Melroses and their oh-so-privileged class. The fourth book in the series, Mother's Milk, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize and was awarded France's top prize for foreign literature, the Prix Féminin Étranger. The final novel is called At Last. It's set on the day of Eleanor's funeral when the members of the extended family come together. It's the day on which Patrick says to a friend, "I think my mother's death is the best thing that happened to me since, well, since my father's death." Edward, welcome to Adelaide.
Thank you.
We're going to ask you to read a section in a moment, but first perhaps we could just describe for the radio audience where we are. This is a lovely setting, isn't it?
Yes, it's beautiful. We're in Adelaide here in a park setting, and the weather is perfect.
And with a great sea of people looking out at us under the trees here in the Pioneer Women's Garden, and the River Torrens just at the back there. So it's a completely beautiful day. Now, before we have your reading, can we just meet you? I mean, St. Albans is a splendidly distinguished-sounding name. Can you tell us about your family? About the background?
It was originally a French family, and they came over with William the Conqueror. So there you go. And they've lived in the same place for a long time and all of that.
So in conventional terms, the family has lived in a world of privilege for centuries.
Yes, there's something in England called the Doomsday Book, which was William the Conqueror's tax collecting record, and they still owned land which they're recorded in the Doomsday Book as owning at the time, which was 1087 possibly. So there's lots of continuity.
Well, let's have a little reading. Do you want to set up the reading we're about to have?
Sure. This is the opening passage of At Last, the final book. And Nicholas Pratt, who's a poisonous friend of Patrick's father, turns up unexpectedly at the funeral, and it begins with a monologue from him, which I haven't got time to read all of, but I'll read you part of it. "Surprised to see me," said Nicholas Pratt, planting his walking stick on the crematorium carpet and fixing Patrick with a look of slightly aimless defiance, a habit no longer useful but too late to change. "I become rather a memorial creeper, one's bound to at my age. It's no use sitting at home guffawing over the ignorant mistakes of juvenile obituaries or giving in to the rather monotonous pleasure of counting the daily quota of extinct contemporaries. No, one has to celebrate the life. There goes the school tart. They say he had a good war, but I know better. That sort of thing. Put the whole achievement in perspective. Mind you, I'm not saying it isn't all very moving. There's a sort of swelling orchestra effect to these last days, and plenty of horror, of course, padding about on my daily rounds from hospital bed to memorial pew and back again. I'm reminded of those oil tankers that used to dash themselves onto the rocks every other week, and the flocks of birds dying on the beaches with their wings stuck together and their bewildered yellow eyes blinking. Nicholas glanced into the room. Thinly attended, he murmured, as if preparing a description for someone else. Are those people your mother's religious friends? Too extraordinary. What colour would you call that suit? Aubergine? Aubergine à la crème d'Auxerre. I must get Huntsman to get one knocked up. What do you mean you have no aubergine? Everyone was wearing it at Eleanor Melrose's. Order a mile of it straight away. I suppose your aunt will be here soon. She'll be an all too familiar face amidst the aubergines. I saw her last week in New York, and I'm pleased to say I was the first to tell her the tragic news about your mother. She burst into tears and ordered a croque monsieur to swallow with her second helping of diet pills. I felt sorry for her and got her asked to dinner with the Blands. Do you know Freddie Bland? He's the smallest billionaire alive. His parents were practically dwarfs, like General and Mrs. Tom Thumb. They used to come into the room with a tremendous fanfare and then disappear under a console table. Baby Bland has taken to being serious, the way some people do in their senile twilight. She's decided to write a book about cubism, of all ridiculous subjects. I think it's really part of her being a perfect wife. She knows what a state Freddie used to get into over her birthday, but thanks to her new hobby, all he has to do now is get Sotheby's to wrap up a revolting painting of a woman with a face like a slice of watermelon by that arch-fake Picasso, and he knows she'll be over the moon. Do you know what baby said to me? At breakfast, if you please, when I was almost defenceless, Nicholas put on a simpering voice. Those divine birds in late Brock are really just an excuse for the sky. Such a good excuse, I said, choking on my sip of coffee. So much better than a lawnmower or a pair of clogs. It shows he was in complete control of his material. Serious, you see. It's a fate I shall resist with every last scrap of my intelligence, unless Herr Dr. Alzheimer takes over, in which case I'll have to write a book about Islamic art to show that the Tullheads have always been much more civilized than us, or a fat volume on how little we know about Shakespeare's mother and her top-secret Catholicism. Something serious. Anyway, I'm afraid your Aunt Nancy rather bombed with the Blands. It must be hard to be exclusively social and entirely friendless at the same time. Poor thing. But do you know what struck me, apart from Nancy's vibrant self-pity, which she had the nerve to pretend was grief? What struck me about those two girls, your mother and your aunt, was that they are, were, my life has spent wobbling between tenses, completely American. Their father's connection with the Highlands was, let's face it, entirely liquid. And after your grandmother sacked him, he was hardly ever around. He spent the war with those dimwits, the Windsors, in Nassau, Monte Carlo after the war, and finally founded in the Bar of Whites. Of the tribe who are blind drunk every day of their lives from lunch until bedtime, he was by far the most charming. But frustrating, I think, as a father. At that level of drunkenness, one's essentially trying to embrace a drowning man. The odd eruption of sentimentality for the 20 minutes the drink took him that way was no substitute for the steady flow of self-sacrificing kindness, which has always inspired my own efforts as a father. With what I admit have been mixed results. As I'm sure you know, Amanda hasn't spoken to me for the last 15 years. I blame her psychoanalyst, filling her never very brilliant little head with Freudian ideas about her doting papa.
Edward St. Auburn reading from, at last, his latest novel, the final novel in the Melrose series, and he's our guest here at Adelaide Writers Week, coming to you from the banks of the Torrens River. Nicholas's sardonic humour is typical of a whole class of people. I mean, he's standing in for a whole attitude to life. He's not alone in this way of approaching the world.
He's not alone, he's the exemplification of the contempt and snobbery that characterised Patrick's father, David. And I didn't know how to begin this novel, and when I started it with the word "surprised to see me," it was because I was surprised to see Nicholas Pratt. He hadn't been around for years, but by bringing him back, I could bring back the concerns of the first three novels and join them with the concerns of Mother's Milk and bring the whole thing to an end.
So these are witty people. In fact, irony and the smart put-down are part of the currency of their conversation.
Absolutely. The English have a strange habit of being rude to each other in order to show how close they are, rather than affectionate. I suppose it shows that if you're prepared to tolerate that level of rudeness, you must like them. And I think irony obviously as a social device is in the books very, very much, but also it's as a journey for Patrick, at a rhetorical level, his journey is towards giving up irony. There's a passage in At Last where he says it's the hardest addiction of all, and because it's an attempt to mean two things at once, and by the end of the novel he's able to mean one thing at once, which is a huge achievement for him.
So this book, the last of the five books, set on the occasion of his mother's funeral, is a way in which you're able to take stock of the five stories. There's a lot of looking back and revisiting incidents that we've experienced in the earlier books. So for people who are not familiar with the story, perhaps we could now take stock ourselves. So Patrick's father, David, who is the dreadful fellow who kind of haunts the entire series, who is he?
He's principally in this book a rapist, and it turns out also rather that he's shot someone in the head in the past. These memories come back gradually, and Patrick's first swimming lesson consisted of being thrown into a pool before he knew how to swim, on the grounds that his desire to survive would teach him how to get to the side of the pool. So he has all sorts of educational theories which justify his sadism and unpleasantness.
He made up his mind to circumcise his own son on the table at home.
Yes, he drunkenly performs an amateur circumcision on the kitchen table. So he's an unusual person, and thank goodness. But he's also a failure. He's also someone who's haunted by a sense of his own lost potential. And he's castrated by having married a relatively rich woman and not having money of his own. He's someone who's suffering in his own right. And so the novel doesn't portray him as a monster, but as someone with a lot of mental illness, which he successfully funnels into his son.
Yes, in some ways you can see him as an individual suffering from mental illness, but you can also see him as representative of an attitude to life which is more widely held.
Yes, I mean he belongs to a brand of snobbery which is extinct by now, but really hardcore, old-fashioned, genealogical snobbery, contempt, the dismissal of ordinary morality as a kind of herd mentality which he's superior to. All of that is a disguise. It's the decoration which is ready to hand for someone of his background to cover up a profoundly sadistic nature.
He loves telling that story about shooting the man in the head. So the story is that he was on a pig hunting expedition in India. One of the party, one of his companions, was bitten and contracted rabies.
Yes, that's right. Yes, pig sticking, I think it should be. I think that's the technical term. It's more evocative. Exactly, and one of the party gets rabies, and he's trussed up in the net, which is usually used for the bodies of the carcasses of the wild boar that have been killed with a lance. And he's interrupting dinner because he's screaming a lot, and they're all having a rather delicious dinner in this wild place in India. And so David gets up and goes into the tent and gets his revolver and walks over to the man who's writhing in the net and shoots him in the head. And then goes back to the table, and the other people on the expedition are a little bit shocked, and they include judges and people high up in the administration of the country. And he sits down completely calmly and says, "Much the kindest thing to do." And gradually, everyone at the table comes round to his point of view. So he has this charismatic presence, which is also a disturbing thing about him. So he's not just horrible, he's also charismatic, also brilliant. So a confusing presence.
See, told another way, it would be like a Monty Python sketch.
Yes.
You know, much the kindest thing to do, and chaps going, "Yes, quite right, absolutely."
Absolutely, but it isn't a Monty Python sketch. I'll leave that.
Is it based on a real event?
You know, my father did used to tell that story, yes. I'll tick that box. I don't necessarily want to go from the fiction back to what really happened time and again, but why not? On that occasion, yes, he did tell that story, and it was impressive because what he was saying at one level was that he was prepared to kill people if they got on his nerves.
Yes, I suppose that's making your position clear. So let's then talk about Patrick. And just to remind the listener, Patrick is a young man who, as a boy, was raped by this man, David, his father. And really the story is, over these five books, is Patrick's journey into hell and out again, I think. Just tell us who Patrick is. What's the journey he's been through, this labyrinth that he's been through, as we now know him in this final book at last?
Well, he gets raped, as we've already revealed in the first book. Each book is set on one day in one place, except for Mother's Milk. And so we don't know at that point whether it's an isolated incident or not. But he gets raped in the first book, and he's psychologically annihilated, and the world sort of splits in half for him because he can't bear what's happening to him, and kind of escapes, becomes disembodied, and escapes into the body of a gecko, which scuttles across the roof of the house. So he has this very charged, magical relationship with the landscape, which in some ways saved him. And at the same time, he's, if you like, realistically destroyed. But that sets up a habit of wanting to be in two places at once, of never feeling safe in his own body. And that's why, at the rhetorical level, giving up irony, not meaning two things at once, is such a triumph, because it's the end of this split. So then he becomes predictably a heroin addict because he simply can't bear his own thoughts, feelings and memories, and finds these small set of sensations which are strong enough to displace them, and becomes addicted to drugs. In the second book he visits New York to collect his father's remains, and he's a heroin addict, and he wants to be free. I mean, the story of all these books are governed by the question of how can Patrick become free? How can he see through his own conditioning and have a voluntary life? But in Bad News, he's someone who loathes his father, but who's still using, if you like, his father's methods to fight him. He's still filled with hatred and contempt, and so it's not a battle he's able to win. And so the story goes on, and then in the third book he's you know, sober and looking back with some clarity on his past, and tells a friend for the first time what happened to him. So his isolation comes to an end.
On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily with Michael Cathcart. I'm at Adelaide Writers Week with you, and my guest on the platform here is the British novelist Edward St. Auburn. So just to continue that line, that narrative line, in the previous book to this, book number four, Mother's Milk, Patrick is gripped by a sense of entitlement about losing his inheritance, which is a mansion at a place called Saint-Nazaire, which is in France. What did that house represent to him?
Well, as I said, because of the gecko and the way in which he, in the absence of any kind of parental care, he spent his childhood imagining that he's being looked after by the land and by the animals, and he's not just whining about losing a property, which would be annoying enough, but he feels he's going to lose his sanity when the house is given away by his mother to an Irish neo-shaman called Seamus, who runs something called a transpersonal association. And
he's a rather shameless Seamus, isn't he, really?
He is, definitely. And and so mother's milk is... The family are allowed to use the house during the height of the summer, and the rest of the time it's a shamanic center. And it's set over the summers leading up to the loss of the house, and his mother's descent into senility.
One of the powerful realizations that he makes in this book is that he's not looking for consolation anymore.
Yes. Yes, that seems to be the key to, or one of the keys to his liberation in At Last, is that he's, by losing the house, if you like, he loses his primary consolatory system. That's what he consoled himself with as a child. And then he went on to console himself with drink and drugs and every other obvious consolation. And it's so there's something about renouncing that, no longer looking for consolation.
So it's the laying aside of irony and the laying aside of the need for consolation.
Yes.
Those twin renunciations that are his liberation.
Those are two key elements, absolutely.
So this is the day of his mother's funeral and everybody's gathered. And no one's really agreed on who Eleanor was. Everybody's got a different version of who this woman was.
That's right. I think in all these books, but particularly in the last two, there's an arena of perspectives on a situation. And the truth is established really by letting everyone have their perspective. And Annette, who's from the Transpersonal Foundation, thinks that Eleanor's a saint, you know, and Nancy, her snobbish sister, thinks she's a class traitor, and Patrick thinks she's a dreadful mother, and Mary, Patrick's wife, thinks that, you know, she's a bad mother, but from the point of view of another mother, and so on and so forth. And Johnny, an old friend of Patrick's, who is a psychoanalyst, and perhaps this is where the novel comes to some sort of rest, just thinks she's drastically lacking in self-knowledge. You know.
Nancy's one of the many marvellously funny creations in this book, and she's got two really memorable moments. One is when she complains about the date that's been chosen for the funeral, and she says, "It's Prince Charles's wedding. The only other people who might have come will be at Windsor."
Yes. She's very, very keen. Nicholas and Nancy are a good sort of tag team. But they, you know, they're very keen to see themselves as belonging to an elite. But Nancy turns out to be a sort of impoverished kleptomaniac with a toxic nostalgia for the grandeur of her upbringing. And Nicholas dies of a heart attack in the course of affirming that he's completely free of any imperfection. So they don't do too well, the elitists.
As I was reading the book, I thought that Patrick was going to harbour a fear that he was going to repeat the sins of the father, that David's cultural or mental DNA was encoded within him. But then I discover that what he's really afraid of is that he will be a replay of his mother. Can you talk to me about that?
You were right the first time. He's much more concerned about being a replay of his father, and that's the civil war that's raging in him in Bad News. You know, how can he free himself from his father if he's so identified with him? You know, his entire life has been partly as a victim of his father and partly as an opponent of his father, but the means of war are his father's means. So he needs to become freer than he is in bad news. And I think the telling Johnny the truth, you know, the one who later becomes a psychoanalyst, you know, telling the truth is the initial thing that sets him free from that. And when we see him as a father in Mother's Milk, he's a kind father, but an anxious father. You know, he's a father who's had a bad childhood and who's therefore, you know, not a naturally good father, but a laboriously good father. But I don't see in what sense you thought he might become like his mother.
Well, that's a misreading, and then you've made it very clear that you thought he was escaping the hold of his father, which seemed to me the way to do it. I can't really remember why I thought he was afraid that he might be more like his mother now. I guess in a kind of complicity.
Yes.
You know, that there was a complicity with what the father had done, which is just another way of acceding to what the father has been anyway. Now, you've made no secret of the autobiographical basis of these novels. Although you're always very guarded about this as a topic, we do know that things like this have happened to you. What made you decide not to write a memoir about your own, really, obviously very traumatic childhood? Why did you write a novel?
I think because I preferred the distancing effects that are available in a novel. The unities of setting something on one day in one place is very artificial, couldn't be done in a memoir. The creation of a lot of characters who present the reader with this arena of points of view that I've been talking about. The margin for invention, conflation, you know, all the powers of art. And I suppose also because of the books that have influenced me and that I've enjoyed most have been novels and not memoirs. I mean, with some huge exceptions like Speak Memory by Nabokov or whatever. But I always wanted to write a novel. You know, I always felt that novels were where it was at for me. And also, you know, Patrick is an alter ego, so the writer is an aspect of a person, the narrator is an aspect of the writer, the alter ego is an aspect of the narration. So there's a kind of telescopic effect which isn't available in memoir. The first person who's narrating is assumed to be the author. All of those gaps collapse in the case of a memoir. So it seemed to me totally undesirable. And I don't want to make a confession. You know, I'm not making a confession. The most famous autobiographies by Augustine or Rousseau are called confessions. You know, I'm not interested in confession. I was interested in creating something that was entertaining, even if it dealt with very troubling material. I was interested in the transformation of very difficult lived experience into what I hope is enjoyable reading experience.
There must have been a personal commitment to writing the story. It's hard to believe that someone who had been sexually abused as a child by their own father would say, gosh, that would make a good story, that would be entertaining. I mean, I'm assuming that most people imagine that you, with your name on the cover of the book, were also searching for some kind of peace or way of living with what had happened, that Patrick's journey is like your journey.
It is, but on the other hand, writing the books wasn't conducive to peace at all. It was very disturbing. Now that they're all finished, which took me, you know, 22 years, now I have some sense of perhaps it's sublimation, perhaps it's something, you know, raw and ugly and chaotic and disturbing, which has become something relatively serene and well-organized. So I have that, but during the course of writing them, it was the worst thing I could have done as far as being at peace, you know, was concerned. It was extremely upsetting. It was obviously my subject. I tried during my 20s to write, you know, evasive, clever novels about, and they all just died on page 40. And I knew that I had to deal with my experience head on.
So you have gone very deep into your own demons. Has it exorcised them? Are you now a man at peace?
Yes, I mean, sometimes and sometimes not. I do, you know, I don't think life is as monumental as that, you know. But I'm certainly able to, I'm certainly more at peace than I've ever been. I really enjoy life now, which, you know, which I didn't until very recently. And it's great. It's such an improvement on not enjoying it.
As you see these stories of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church unfolding, do you have reflections on what's behind that and what the appropriate response should be?
I know, isn't it odd? I mean, when I started the writing, never mind, it was a really edgy subject. It was a taboo, not only personally for me, but also, you know, a subject that was rarely discussed openly. And now it's on every newspaper. It's front page every day. So that's quite strange. I mean, my reflections are only, you know, ones of sympathy with the people who that's happened to. And the abuse of power is monstrous. And I'm constantly aware of how difficult it is to recover from that kind of situation.
One of Patrick's qualities is that he's a watcher. He observes people. And I wonder whether he's such an acute watcher because his history of abuse has made him watchful.
Absolutely, yes. There's hypervigilance involved. And also when he was young, he asked his father what the most important thing in the world was, and he said, observe everything. And so he acquired pathologically the habit of observing everything as a way of placating his father. And then, you know, found it hard to shake off. It has its uses, observing things.
Let's talk about satire, because in some ways the book is a satire on a particularly privileged and cruel class. The satirist can be quite a lonely figure. If you think of Swift or you think of Pope, the satirist can dramatise himself or herself, I guess, as a mocker, as a person who stands back from the rest of society and says, really, no one measures up. Everything is there to be lampooned. So the satirist is someone who finds mockery easier than empathy.
I don't think it really is a satire, this work as a whole. I think it's a tragedy with frequent bursts of hilarity and comic surface. And I think there are good characters in the first book. There's an American woman called Anne Moore, who kind of stands outside the situation, sees it for what it is. Mary is a figure of considerable goodness and loyalty and so forth. So it's not just a procession of grotesque people. And I don't think it even condemns a class in a kind of uniform way. There are some kind people among this tribe, and there are plenty of people from outside it as well, like Annette, who appears to be a sort of New Age nitwit, but turns out to be a spontaneously good person. So, there are passages of satire, particularly in the third book, set at the big party in the country house. I think that's the most satirical of all, but I don't think it's the dominant note.
By the last volume, this volume you've got on the table there, the books no longer seem to have a narrator. So the narrator's voice is very evident early on, but gradually the narrator recedes. Is that an illusion on my part, or are you conscious of that happening?
No, I think that I'm glad you said that, because that's the progress I think I've made as a writer. And the the mentalities of the characters are just presented directly. There's no one telling you what to think of them. They just present themselves through their speeches, their gestures, and their thoughts. And the narrator has evaporated. So it's very, very direct. And I'm aware of how in Nevermind there was a much, in the first book, there was a much heavier narrative presence. And I'm pleased about that because there isn't a narrator in life. People do just present themselves, the narrator is a device that I'm excited to have got rid of.
On Books and Arts Daily, my guest at Adelaide Writers Week is Edward St. Auban. Was that a conscious decision? I mean, did you make that as a technical choice, or did you just realise afterwards that that had happened?
I think more of the latter. There's always a collaboration between intention and planning and will on the one hand, the active part of the process, and the unconscious or inspiration or the muse or however you want to characterise the other part. And at last was very heavily weighted in favour of the second part. I kept waiting to find out what would happen next. It was a book that I received to a great extent. And so afterwards I did realise that the effect you've described happened. I think I'm interested in urgency and compression, and so it was probably a product of that. You know, why not just have the character walk on and be who they are?
So you've moved beyond irony. You've moved beyond mockery. You've moved beyond the narrator. It's as if you've liberated yourself to become another kind of writer.
A Trappist monk, yeah. And so, yeah, this is my last speech. I'm going to be silent from now on. Yeah.
Who do you think that new writer is?
I don't know. I mean, I've just finished a novel, actually. I just finished one, but I was desperate to finish it before I came to Australia. And I did. And it's a completely different kind of novel, much more playful. You know, you could throw the word harrowing at it and it would bounce right off. And so I guess that's probably, the product of having finished with The Melroses. I have written other novels without The Melroses in them. Two of them, between the first three books and Mother's Milk. So there are novels which are excavated, the Melrose novels, and then there are novels which are constructed, the others. I find something in the world that entertains me or interests me and then build a fiction around it.
Well, at the end of book three, we thought the Melroses were done. And then you came back.
I know. I'm the most unreliable witness on the subject of the Melrose books because I thought I'd finished with them, and then when I wrote Mother's Milk, I stubbornly thought I'd finished with them, although I created a house in the south of France and a compulsively philanthropic mother and all these things which were characteristics of the Melroses. And then I had to admit that it was a Melrose novel, but I'd called my protagonist Mark instead of Patrick, and then I did a change all function on my computer, but I did it badly because I'm not very technologically proficient, and everywhere that the word Mark had been in the novel, Patrick came up, so people were going to a super Patrickette, and Eleanor had puncher Patrick's on her arm, and I mean it was a nightmare. It took me weeks to weed out the consequences of this helpful, speedy process.
The trick is that you put a space before the word.
Thanks.
And a cap.
Why weren't you there when I was doing it? Anyway.
That's the secret. You put a space and a capital and you make it case sensitive. Then just go and they'll all change.
Hang on. Take notes.
It's so simple. So here you are today as a famous and successful author, and you draw this distinction between yourself as an author and yourself as a writer. What's that distinction about?
Do I?
Yes, I read an interview with you in an English newspaper.
The things I say in interviews, I mean, it's unbelievable. I suppose an author is someone who's had a book published, and a writer is the person who's making the book.
So the author knows what he or she has done, and the writer is the more bewildered person.
The writer is the person with the in the process, and I think of myself as a writer because I'm always, you know, het up about what to do next or what I'm doing now, and rather than as an author, although at this particular moment I'm an author.
Phew.
It would be rude to write at the same time.
That's right. Yes, he kept taking notes. He was the most irritating subject to interview. He just kept writing things down. One of the topics I'd like to come to on Books and Arts later in the year is Proust. And I know that you have an intense engagement with Proust. In fact, you've read Proust in the most intense way I've ever heard of. Could you share that with us?
Well, yes, I rented a cottage in the country at one point during my troubled 20s, and I just lived there alone, trying to keep away from the temptations of the city. And I read Proust continuously over 4 months. I'm a very slow reader, but I read the whole of Proust. All I did was keep a fire going and read Proust, and that was the most intense reading experience I've had, because it was completely uninterrupted. And that did have a marked effect on me, and, you know, made me think about the passage of time and, you know, multiple novels and so forth. And I think that that's always seemed to me to be the kind of supreme achievement of the novel. Although, I don't know, I don't want to make it a competition. There are lots of great novels. But anyway, it had a big impact on me.
Where does the humour come from? Does the humour come from novels, or does it come from that great British tradition of television humour?
I did watch a lot of television. I used to love Peter Cook, and I always found that side of British humour very engaging. I suppose it's partly from there, it's partly from war, it's part, you know, it's just how I see the world as well. I see it as heartbreaking and absurd in very rapid alternation. So some of it comes from me.
Yes, I didn't mean to imply it wasn't all your own work.
No, I know. I knew what you meant.
Well played. I think we might have some questions. This is Books and Arts Daily on our incoming to Adelaide Writers' Week, and I'll ask anyone who's got a question, Fred Wood, to come to that microphone just there. Don't be shy. Put your hand up if you've got a question. Who would like to ask a question?
I would like to ask if you had an idea of the whole five novels when you started.
I didn't. I had an idea of the first three novels before I wrote anything at all. I had this kind of denuded structure, you know, that there were going to be three books, the crisis, the consequences of the crisis, and some kind of resolution, which there is within the third book, but not a final resolution. And then I thought I'd completed it. Then when I realised Mother's Milk was a Melrose book, I thought, out of, you know, a sense of symmetry and rather plodding elegance, that I should write a second trilogy. But when I started at last, I realised that I was going to finish the series with the fifth book. So I did have a vision at the beginning, which only turned out to be partial, and since then I've been generally wrong about what's going on.
Hi, just like to go back to your point about Proust, because when I was reading Nevermind, I thought that perhaps you had dunked a very stale and rather unpleasant digestive English biscuit in a cup of tea, and there was a feeling that maybe you'd channeled a rather nicer Madeleine in that first book. Was there a direct thought in that book with Proust?
The Proust is mentioned in Nevermind, I think. It's a long time since I read him. But I think Victor Eisen, the philosopher, and Anne Moore, the nice American, talk about Proust at various points. So he is explicitly mentioned. Lots of writers are alluded to over in the series, and writers that have been important to me. There's Beckett turns up in in Bad News and Juno Barnes and Camus, and yeah, he is. He
I was
is
thinking
mentioned.
With the child and the mother, the dinner party. There seemed to be
the opening
relationship.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Any child longing to be kissed goodnight to by his or her mother is living under the bell jar of Proust, whether they've read him or not. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Edward, I just love the children in Mother's Milk. The two little boys are absolutely delightful, but at the same time, I didn't really find them quite believable as children, and that didn't detract from loving them. I just wondered if you've had experience. Are you a father, or
I have two children, yes, but they're not both boys. That's made up, and they're not that sort of age. But yes, I think I've always had frighteningly easy access to my own childhood, and also empathy with children and with other people, you know. Yes, some people thought that the children said too many clever and interesting things, but I mean, what would you rather? I mean, I think the dialogue and so forth. I think the whole of the Melrose Saga is an improvement on life. I certainly hope so. I think that dialogue should be clearer, sharper, more concentrated in a book than it is in ordinary life.
Edward, I was very interested in your comments about the limitations of memoir.
Yes.
I guess I was thinking about Angela's Ashes, where you get humour, you get entertainment. You can, of course, hide behind fictional characters in a memoir. So, in a lot of ways, the memoir comes very close to novel.
Well, I haven't read Angela's Ashes, and I can't comment on it. But I don't think I could write a memoir which was packed full of fictional characters. I would consider it some kind of responsibility to deal with a factual level of truth. I think that getting to a more essential level of truth is sometimes served by invention and concentration and reframing, etc., etc., all the devices of art. But there's certainly... I read very little contemporary writing. I don't while I'm writing my own things. And then, like now, I could start reading because I'm between novels if I write another one. Anyway, I've just finished one. But there seems to be a lot of interaction between fiction and memoir going on, from what I gather. And a new kind of hybrid territory arising. Where reportage and fiction or reportage has this sort of characteristics of fiction and so forth. And that's fine. I'm just trying to master the novel, you know, it's enough for me. I don't need to try and do anything else. Or I couldn't possibly do anything else.
Thank you.
As I'm sitting here listening to these questions, I realised that as I approached this interview, I assumed that you were going to be cautious about revealing yourself, that in writing these novels, you'd been wary about being too candid about who you were. In the way I would be candid, I wouldn't want to be candid either. There's something I want to keep private, want to keep back. I don't want everyone to know all about my inner self. But I wonder now whether you were also thinking about your father. Was there any part of you that was reluctant to expose him in this way, or did he have it coming?
No, I don't think I've held back in any respect. I think I think paradoxically the third person narrative is a way of being more intimate than a first person narrative, because as soon as you create a character called I, you know, you then have to be consistent with that character, and everything has to be justified by being seen from that character's point of view. So it's a huge limitation, and you've really welded yourself to something that appears to be more authentic, but is in fact only a more limited character than is available through a third-person narration. Unless you have a first-person narration in which the narrator keeps meeting people who then tell long stories, which is one way out. But I've found the first person very, very confining myself. Mm. But I don't think I've held back in any respect. I mean, well,
no, I don't mean you've held back in the books. The books are utterly revealing. But there's a kind of decorum about you as an author, you know, that says, you know, there are places I don't want to go, that I don't want to talk about. And I was just reflecting on the fact suddenly, look, you've told this story about your father. You've painted him in the worst possible light. Did it take some struggle as a son to tell a story that was, we now know, based on what your father had actually done, what your father was actually like?
Yeah, it was an effort. The writing these books was a huge effort, especially the first one. But I mean, as an author, I'm here as someone who's written these books, who's gone on this journey of transformation from something that was overwhelming and unbearable to a book which I hope is enjoyable. So I don't want to take a journey in the opposite direction. My direction is towards liberation and towards enjoyment. You know, I don't particularly want to, you know, catch the wrong train and go back and tell you what it was really like. I've already done that.
Mm. So what's the new one about? Can you tell us that?
I can't, because it hasn't even been copy edited. The books I've written, as I said, the books that are constructions rather than excavations, are about things that catch my attention. One of them was On the Edge, which was about New Age spiritual seekers in California, and one was called A Clue to the Exit, about the debate about the nature of consciousness. And the new one is, again, it's about something substantial in the world. But it's really mainly a... that is a satire, funnily enough. I think you could use the word satire about the new book. And I'll, you know, you'll find out, I hope.
Would you thank Edward St. Auburn? We've been talking to Edward St. Auburn. The Melrose novels are published by Picador, and the final of the series is called At Last. On RN, you've been with Michael Cathcart at Books and Arts Daily at Adelaide Writers' Week. Let's go out with the wonderful sounds of a busker who I recorded in Rundle Mall just a day ago.